The Gulag Archipelago, Volume 2, Section 2, Continued.
Cassette 8, Side 2.
But no, let those who saw them show them. I didn't see them. I have already deduced the generalized judgment that a camp keeper could not be a decent person. Either he had to change direction, or they got rid of him. Let us suppose for just one moment that a camp keeper decided to do good and to replace the currish regimen in his camp with one that was humane. Would he be allowed to? Would they permit it? Would they let this happen? You might just as well leave a samovar out in the frost to heat up. Now, I am willing to accept certain things. There were good men who kept trying unsuccessfully to get out, who had not yet left but who were going to leave. For example, the director of a Moscow shoe factory, M. Garazimov, had his party card taken from him, but they did not expel him from the party. This form of discipline did actually exist. And in the meantime, where could they send him? To Ust-Vim, to be a camp keeper. And they say that he was very unhappy and depressed in this position, and was easy on the zeks. In 5 months' time, he got out of the job and left. And this I can believe, that for those 5 months he was good. And then, too, supposedly, in Ortau, in 1944, there was a camp chief named Smeshko, who was not known to have done anything bad, and he, too, was trying to get out of his job. In the administration of the Northeastern Corrective Labor Camps, the former pilot, Morozov, section chief in 1946, had a decent attitude toward the zeks, and for that he was in the bad books of the administration. Or Captain Siverkin, in Nairovlag, was, they say, a decent man. And what came of that? They sent him to Palma, a penalty work party. And he had two occupations there. He drank hooch and listened to the Western radio. In these localities, the jamming was weak. 1952. And then my neighbour in the railroad car, the Tavda graduate, he also possessed good impulses. There was a young fellow in the corridor who had no ticket and who had been standing a whole day. And so this fellow said, "Shall we make room for him, give him a place, let him get some sleep? But just give him a year's service as a chief, and he will do something else again. He will go to the conductor, 'Get rid of that fellow without a ticket.' Isn't that right? Well, I will speak honestly. I knew one very good MVD man. True, not a camp keeper, but a jail keeper. Lieutenant Colonel Tsukhanov. For a brief while, he was the chief of the special prison at Marfino. Not only I, but all the zeks there admit that no one suffered evil and all experienced good from him. Whenever he could bend the order in the zeks' favor, he invariably did. And whatever he could ease up on, he invariably did. And what happened? They reclassified our special prison into a stricter classification, and he was removed. He was not a young man, had served a long time in the MVD, and how he had done it I don't know. It is a riddle. And Arnold Rappaport assures me that Colonel of Engineers Mikhail Mitrofanovich Marksev, an army field engineer who from 1943 to 1947 was chief of Vorkutlag, both the construction project and the camp, was supposedly a good man. In the presence of Czechists, he shook the hands of Czech engineers and addressed them politely. He could not stand career Czechists, and he held in contempt the chief of the political branch, Colonel Kuchtikov. And when he was commissioned with a state security rank, General Commissar, third rank, he refused. Can that be? He said, "I am an engineer." And he got his way. He became an ordinary general. During the years of his administration, Rappaport assures me not one single camp case was ever set in motion in Vorkuta. And these, after all, were the war years, the very period for all those camp cases. His wife was the prosecutor for the city of Vorkuta and succeeded in paralyzing the creative work of the camp security officers. This is a very important piece of evidence, if only A. Rappaport is not exaggerating involuntarily because of his own privileged position as an engineer at that time. Somehow, I find it hard to really believe it. Why, then, did they not get rid of this Maltsev? After all, he must have been in everyone's way. Let us hope that someone, some day, will establish the truth here. Commanding a division of field engineers at Stalingrad, Maltsev could summon a regimental commander in front of the lineup and shoot him himself. He was sent to Vorkuta in disfavor, but not for that, for something else. In this, and in other similar cases, faulty memory and extraneous personal impressions sometimes distort recollections. And when they speak about good men, one wishes to ask, good to whom? To all? And former frontline officers were by no means an improvement as replacements for veteran MVD men. Chulpenyov bears witness that things got no better, but even worse, when an old camp dog was replaced at the end of the war by a frontline officer invalided out, like regimental commissar Yegorov. Understanding nothing at all of camp life, they issued careless, superficial orders, and then went out of the camp compound on a drinking spree with some broads, turning the camp over to the scoundrels from among the trustees. However, those who shout particularly loudly about good Czechists in camps, these being the loyalist orthodox communists, do not have in mind good in the sense in which we understand it. They don't mean those who tried to create a generally humane condition for all imprisoned there at the cost of deviating from the savage instructions of Gulag. No, they consider those camp keepers good who honestly carried out all the currish instructions, who tore to pieces and tormented the whole crowd of prisoners, but did favors for the former communists. What breadth of view the loyalists have. They are always the heirs of universal human culture. There actually were, of course, such good camp keepers as these, and no few of them. For example, Kudlaty, with his volumes of Lenin, wasn't he such a one? Dyakov tells about one, and here was his nobility. During a business trip to Moscow, the chief of camp visited the home of one of the Orthodox communist prisoners serving time in his camp, and returned, and immediately went right on carrying out all his Kurdish duties. And General Gorbatov recalls a good Kolyma camp keeper. People are accustomed to consider us some sort of monsters of cruelty, but this opinion is erroneous. We, too, enjoy communicating good news to a prisoner. But the letter from Gorbatov's wife, in which the passage where she warned him about the reconsideration of his case, was blacked out by the censor. Why did they deprive themselves of the enjoyment of communicating good news? But Gorbatov sees no contradiction in this. The chiefs say it, and the army general believes it. And what that good Kolyma cur was worried about was that Gorbatov might say something up top about the tyranny in his camp. That was why that pleasant conversation took place. And at the very end, be careful in your conversations. And Gorbatov again understood nothing at all. And here, in his Vestia, September 6, 1964, Levkovich writes a so-called passionate, but in our opinion, a signed, article. She had known several good, intelligent, strict, sad, tired, etc., Czechists. And a certain Kapustin in Jambul had tried to arrange jobs for the exiled wives of communists, and because of this was forced to shoot himself. Now, this is total delirium. Nonsense. The commandant is obliged to arrange work for exiles, even by compulsion. And if he really did shoot himself, what this means is that it was because he had either embezzled or got in a mess with some broads. But what was the central organ of the former VTSIK, Izvestia, the very same that had approved of all the Gulag cruelties, trying to prove? It was saying that if there were some good serf owners, then there had never been any serfdom in general. Yes, and here is another good camp keeper. Our Ekibastutz Lieutenant Colonel Matveyev. Under Stalin, he showed and clacked his sharp teeth. But once Papa Stalin had died and Beria had had it, Matveyev became a leading liberal, the father of the natives. Well, until the next change of wind anyway. But on the quiet, even during that year, he instructed the Brigadier Alexandrov, if someone doesn't obey you, punch him in the snoot. Nothing will happen to you, I promise. No good man like that are good only until the wind changes. All that kind of good men are good and cheap. In our view, they were only good when they themselves served time in camp. And some did serve time. But what they were tried for was not for that. The camp custodial staff was considered the junior command staff of the MVD. These were the Gulag non-coms, and that was the kind of assignment they had, to worry the prey and not let go. They were on the same Gulag ladder, only lower. As a result, they had fewer rights, and they had to use their own hands more often. However, they were not sparing of their hands, and if they were required to bloody someone up in the penalty isolator or in the jailer's room, three of them would boldly beat up on one, even until they had knocked him out. Year by year, they coarsened in the service, and you couldn't observe in them the least cloudlet of pity toward the soaked, freezing, hungry, tired, and dying prisoners. In relation to them, the prisoners were just as deprived of rights, and just as defenseless, as in relation to the big chiefs. And they could bring pressure to bear on the prisoners in the same way, and feel themselves to be high up. And they could vent their malice and display cruelty. They encountered no barriers. And when you start beating with impunity, once you've started, you don't want to stop. Tyranny incites you, and you feel yourself to be so ferocious that you are afraid even of yourself. The jailers willingly copied their officers in their conduct, and in character traits too. But they didn't have that gold on their shoulder boards, and their greatcoats were dirtyish, and they went everywhere on foot, and they were not allowed prisoner servants, and they dug in their own gardens, and looked after their own farm animals. Well, of course, they did manage to haul off a zec to their places for half a day now and then, to chop wood, to wash floors. This they could do, but not on a lavish scale. And not using the working zecs either, but those resting. Tabatarov, in Beritsniki, in 1930, had only just lain down after a 12-hour night shift when the jailer awakened him and sent him to his house to work, and just try not to go. The jailers had no patrimonial estates. The camp for them, after all, was not a patrimonial estate, but their service, and therefore they did not have either that arrogance or that despotic scope. And there were obstacles in the way of thievery, too. This was an injustice. Even without thievery, the chiefs had plenty of money, and they could steal much, too. And the custodial staff had much less, and were allowed to steal less, too. No one was going to give you a full bag from the storeroom, hardly even a small pouch. Right now I can see before my eyes, as if it were today, the big-faced, flaxen-haired Sergeant Kisilyov. He came into the bookkeeping office in 1945 and ordered, "Don't issue 1 ounce of fats and oils to the Zec kitchen, only to the free employees." There were not enough fats, and this was their whole advantage, fats according to the norm. In order to have something sewn for them in the camp tailor shop, they had to have the camp chief's permission and wait their turn. Well, at work you could make the Zec do a small task for you, solder, cook, hammer, or sharpen something. Anything larger than a stool you'd not always manage to carry out. This limitation on thievery deeply affronted the jailers, especially their wives, and because of this there was much bitterness against the chiefs. Because of this life seemed very unjust, and within the jailer's breast there stirred not so much sensitive heartstrings as a sense of unfulfillment, an emptiness echoing a human groan. And sometimes the lower-ranking jailers were capable of talking sympathetically with the Zecs. Not so often, but not all that rarely either. In any case, among both prison and camp jailers, it was possible to find human beings. Every prisoner encountered more than one in his career. In an officer, it was virtually impossible. This, properly speaking, was the universal law of the inverse ratio between social position and humaneness. The real jailers were those who had served in camp 15 and 25 years. Whoever had once settled down in those accursed distant places would never be able to clamber out again. Once they had memorized the statute and daily routine, there was nothing else in their whole lives that they had to read or know, and all they did was to listen to the radio, the Moscow program number one. And it was their core that constituted for us the vacantly expressionless, unwavering face of Gulag, inaccessible to any thought. Only during the war years was the composition of the jailer's staff distorted and muddied. The military authorities, in their haste, disregarded the sanctity of the custodial service and took some of them away to the front, and in place of them began to send soldiers from army units released from hospitals. But even from these they selected the stupidest and cruelest. And old men turned up as well, mobilized straight here from home. And among these grey-moustached fellows were many good-hearted, unprejudiced people. They spoke gently, searched perfunctorily, confiscated nothing, and even joked. They never registered complaints, nor reported people to be sent to the punishment cell. But after the war they were soon demobilized, and there weren't any more of them. There were unusual individuals among the jailers, in wartime too, like the student Senin, about whom I have already written, and one other Jewish jailer in our camp at Kaluga Gates, elderly, with a very civilian appearance, very calm, not fault-finding, and no one suffered misfortune from him. He was so mild in his bearing that on one occasion I was bold enough to ask, "Tell me, what is your civilian profession?" He took not the slightest offence, looked at me with calm eyes, and quietly replied, "Merchant." During the war, before coming to our camp, he had served in Podolsk, where, as he related, 13 or 14 people had died every day of the war from starvation. And that alone makes 20,000 deaths. He evidently lasted out the war in the armies of the NKVD, and now he had to be nimble and not get stuck there for good. But take Master Sergeant Tkach, the dreaded assistant to the chief of regiment of the Ekibastutz camp, who fitted him with the jailers just as if he had been specially cast in a mould, as if from his diapers on he had served only there, as if he had been born along with Gulag. His was always an immobile, ominous face beneath a black forelock. It was frightening merely to be next to him, or to run into him on a camp path. He would not walk past without doing a person harm, ordering him to turn back, compelling him to work, taking something away from him, scaring him, punishing him, placing him under arrest. Even after the evening roll call, when the barracks were all locked, but in summertime the barred windows were left open, Tkach would creep silently up to the windows, listen there, then peer in. The whole room would be rustling. And from outside the windowsill, like a black bird of night, he would announce punishments through the grating, for not sleeping, for talking, for making or using something forbidden. And all of a sudden, Tkach disappeared for good, and the rumour swept through camp. It was impossible to check it out, nonetheless such persistent rumours as this were usually correct, that he had been exposed as a fascist executioner on occupied territory, that he had been arrested and had received a whole quart, 25 years. This was in 1952. How had it happened, however, that a fascist executioner, for no more than 3 years, certainly, had for 7 years after the war been in the best graces of the MVD? You tell me. The convoy opens fire without warning. This invocation encompassed the whole special statute of the convoy and its power over us on the other side of the law. When we say convoy, we are using the everyday term of the archipelago. They used to say, too, and even more often in the corrective labour camps, the VOKHR, the Militarized Guards, or simply OKHR. Their full title was Militarized Guard Service of the MVD, and convoy was only one of the possible services of the VOKHR, along with service on watch duty, perimeter duty, patrol duty, and in battalion. Convoy service, even when there was no war, was like front-line service. The convoy had nothing to fear from any investigation and did not have to give any explanations. Every convoy guard who fired was right. every prisoner killed was guilty of wanting to escape or of stepping across the line. Take two murders at the Ortao camp, and you can multiply them by the total number of camps. A guard was leading a group under convoy, and a person not under convoy went up to his girlfriend in the group and walked along beside her. Move away! Is it doing you any harm? A shot. Killed. A comedy of a trial, and the guard was acquitted. He had been insulted while carrying out service duties. At the gatehouse, a Zek ran up to another guard with a release document. He was going to be released the next day, and asked, "Let me through, I'm going to the laundry outside the camp compound. I'll only be a minute." "You can't." "But tomorrow I'm going to be free, fool." The guard shot him dead, killed. And there wasn't even a trial. And how easy it was for a prisoner not to notice in the heat of his work those blazes on the trees, which constituted an imaginary dotted line, a forest cordon instead of barbed wire. For example, Solovyov, a former army lieutenant, cut down a fir tree and, moving backward, was cleaning the branches off it. He saw only his felled tree. And a convoy guard, a Tonshoyevo wolf, squinted and waited. He wouldn't call out to the Zek, "Watch out." He just waited, and Solovyov, not noticing, crossed the line of the work zone, continuing to back his way down the tree trunk. A shot, an explosive bullet, and a lung was blown apart. Solovyov was killed, and the Tonshoyevo wolf got a 100-ruble prize. Tonshoyevo wolves were the local inhabitants of Tonshoyevo district near Burepolom, who had all enlisted in the VOKHR during the war, so as to be closer to home and not go to the front. This was the same Tonshoyevo district where the children used to shout, "Mama, here comes a herring!" This absoluteness in the relations between the convoy and the prisoners, this continual right of the guards to use a bullet instead of a word, could not fail to influence the character of the VOKHR officers and the VOKHR enlisted men as well. The lives of the prisoners were given into their power, though not for the whole day, yet totally and profoundly. To them, the natives were not people, they were some sort of lazy, animated scarecrows whom fate had given them to count, to drive to work and from work as swiftly as possible, and to keep at work as densely crowded together as possible. But tyranny was even more intense among the officers of the VOKHR. These young whippersnappers of lieutenants had acquired a balefully despotic sensation of power over existence. Some were only loud-mouthed, Senior Lieutenant Chorny in Nyroblag. Others reveled in cruelty and even let it carry over to their own soldiers, Lieutenant Samutin in the same camp. Still others did not recognize any limitations on their omnipotence. The commander of VOKHR Nevsky, camp number 3 at Ustvim, discovered the loss of his dog. Not a service dog, but his beloved little lap dog. He went to look for it, of course, in the camp compound, and it was his luck to catch 5 natives dividing up the carcass. He pulled out his pistol and shot one dead on the spot. There were no administrative consequences over the incident, except punishment of the remaining 4 Zeks and the penalty isolator. In 1938, in the area west of the Urals, a forest fire flew with the speed of a hurricane along the Vishera River, and from the forest into 2 camps. What was to be done with the Zeks? The decision had to be made instantly. There was no time to consult with higher jurisdictions. The guard refused to release them, and they all burned to death. That was the easy way. If they had been released and escaped, the guards would have been court-martialed. There was only one limitation in VOKHR service on the bubbling energy of its officers. The platoon was the basic unit, and all that omnipotence came to an end above the platoon and in rank above lieutenant. Advancement in the battalion simply had the effect of separating the officer from the actual and real power of the platoon, and was a dead-end street. And as a result, the most power-hungry and powerful of the VOKHR officers tried to leapfrog into the internal service of the MVD and to get their promotion there. Certain famous Gulag biographies consisted indeed of this. The already mentioned Antonov, the ruler of the Road of the Dead in the Arctic, had risen from a VOKHR commander, and his whole education was through the fourth grade. There is no doubt that inside the ministry, the selection of the infantry guard of the MVD was considered of great importance, and the military conscription centres had secret instructions on this. The military conscription centres conduct a great deal of secret work, yet we take a benign attitude toward them. Why, for example, has there been such a determined rejection of the 20s concept of territorial armies, the project of Frunze? And why is it exactly to the contrary that the newly called recruits are sent with exceptional persistence to serve in armies that are as far as possible from their own region? Azerbaijanians to Estonia, Latvians to the Caucasus, etc. Because the armies must be alien to the local population, and preferably even of a different race, as was tested in Novocherkassk in 1962. And so, in the selection of convoy troops there was, not without design, a higher percentage of Tatars and other minority nationalities. Their inferior education and their lack of information were valuable to the state. They were its fortress. But the real scientific organization and training of these armies only began at the same time as the special camps, the Osoblagi, at the end of the 40s and the beginning of the 50s. They began to take only 19-year-old boys and immediately would subject them to intense ideological irradiation. We are going to discuss this convoy separately. But until then, it somehow seemed to be beyond their reach in Gulag. The truth was that not all our people, even though socialist, had yet risen to that steadfast, cruel level necessary for a worthy camp guard. The VOKHR staff was uneven and ceased to be the wall of horror it was intended to be. It softened up, especially in the years of the Soviet-German War. The very best trained, in good viciousness, of the young fellows had to be surrendered to the front, and sickly reservists were dragged into VOKHR, too unhealthy to be suitable for the active army, and too untrained in viciousness for Gulag. They were not brought up in the right years. In the most mercilessly hungry war years in camp, this relaxation of the VOKHR, wherever it took place, it didn't take place everywhere, at least partially eased the life of the prisoners. Nina Samshel recollects her father, who in 1942 was called up into the army at an advanced age and sent to serve as a guard in a camp in Archangel Province. His family joined him there. At home, my father spoke bitterly about life in camp and about the good people who were there. When my papa had to guard a brigade all by himself at a prison farm, this too was wartime, one guard for the whole brigade, wasn't that a relaxation? I often went to see him there, and he allowed me to talk with the prisoners. The prisoners had a lot of respect for my father. He was never rude to them, and he let them go to the store, for example, when they asked, and they never tried to escape from him. They said to me, "Now, if only all the convoy guards were like your father." He knew that many innocents had been imprisoned, and he was always indignant, but only at home. In the platoon he could say nothing. The guard Samshel knew, but our elite writers did not know. They imprisoned people for that. At the end of the war he was immediately demobilized. But one cannot consider Samshel a typical wartime model. His subsequent fate shows it. In 1947, he himself was arrested under Article 58. And in 1950, he was released because he was dying and allowed to return home, where he died 5 months later. After the war, this loose sort of guarding still lasted a year or two, and it somehow began to happen that many of the VOKHR guards also began to talk of their service as their sentence. "When I finish my sentence..." They understood the shame of their service, the kind of service you could not talk about to the family at home. In that same Ortau, one convoy guard intentionally stole something from the KVCH and was dismissed from the service and convicted and immediately amnestied, and the other guards envied him. He had found the way. Smart boy. N. Stolyarova recalls a guard who caught her at the beginning of an escape attempt and concealed her attempt, and she was not punished. One other shot himself out of love for a Zechka sent off on a prisoner transport. Before the introduction of real severities in the women's camps, friendly, good, yes, and even loving relations between the women prisoners and the convoy guards had often begun. Not even our great state had managed to stamp out goodness and love everywhere. The young reinforcements of the post-war years also did not become immediately what Gulag wanted them to be. When a member of the Nairoblag infantry guards, Vladilen Zadorny, mutinied, we will have more to say about him, his mates in the service, who were of his age, took a very sympathetic attitude towards his resistance. Self-guarding constitutes a special area in the history of the camp guard. Back, indeed, in the first post-revolutionary years, it was proclaimed that self-watch was a duty of Soviet prisoners. This was employed at Solovki, not without success, and very widely on the White Sea-Baltic Canal and on the Moscow-Volga Canal. Every socially friendly prisoner who did not wish to push a wheelbarrow could take up a rifle against his comrades. We will not affirm that this was a special, diabolical plan for the moral disintegration of the people. As always in the half-century of our most recent modern history, a lofty, bright theory and creeping moral vileness somehow got naturally interwoven and were easily transformed into one another. But from the stories of the old Zeks, it has become known that the prisoner trusty guards were cruel to their own brothers, strove to curry favour and to hold on to their dogs' duties, and sometimes settled old accounts with a bullet on the spot. And this has also been noted in our literature on jurisprudence. In many cases, those who were deprived of freedom carried out their duties of guarding the colonies and maintaining order better than the staff jailers. Vyshinsky. And so, tell me, what bad is there that one cannot teach a nation, or people, or all humanity? That particular quotation came from the 30s, and Zadorny confirms it as being also true for the end of the 40s. The trusty guards were vicious toward their comrades, used formal reasons for entrapment, and shot them. And in Parma, the penalty expedition of Nairoblag, the only prisoners were the 58s, and the trusty guards were also 58s. Politicals. Vladilen tells about the trusty guard Kudzma, a former chauffeur, a young fellow little more than 20 years old. In 1949, he had received a tenner for 58-10. How was he to survive? He could find no other way. In 1952, Vladilen found him working as a trusty guard. His situation tormented him, and he said he could not bear the burden of his rifle. When he went out on guard duties, he often didn't load it. At night, he wept, calling himself a mercenary coward, and he even wanted to shoot himself. He had a high forehead, a nervous face. He loved verses, and he went off with Vladilen into the taiga to recite them. And then again, he used to take up his rifle. And he knew a trusty guard named Alexander Lunin, who was already well along in years and whose grey locks formed a wreath about his forehead, and who had a kind, good-natured smile. In the war, he had been an infantry lieutenant, and then the chairman of a collective farm. He had received a tenner, under a non-political article, because he had refused to give in to the demands of the district party committee and had arranged distributions to the collective farmers on his own, which means he was that kind of man. His neighbours were dearer to him than he himself was. And there, in Nairoblag, he became a trusty guard, and even earned a reduction in his term from the chief of the Promeshutochnaya camp. The bounds of a human being, no matter how you are astounded by them, you can never comprehend. Chapter 21. Campside. Like a piece of rotten meat, which not only stinks right on its own surface, but also surrounds itself with a stinking molecular cloud of stink, so, too, each island of the archipelago created and supported a zone of stink around itself. This zone, more extensive than the archipelago itself, was the intermediate transmission zone between the small zone of each individual island and the big zone, the big camp compound comprising the entire country. Everything of the most infectious nature in the archipelago, in human relations, morals, views, and language, in compliance with the universal law of osmosis in plant and animal tissue, seeped first into this transmission zone and then dispersed through the entire country. It was right here in the transmission zone that those elements of camp ideology and culture worthy of entering into the nationwide culture underwent trial and selection. And when camp expressions ring in the corridors of the new building of the Moscow State University, or when an independent woman in the capital delivers a verdict wholly from out of camp on the essence of life, don't be surprised. It got there via the transmission zone, via campside. While the government attempted, or perhaps did not attempt, to re-educate the prisoners through slogans, the cultural and educational sections, censorship of mail, and the security chiefs, the prisoners more swiftly re-educated the entire country through campside. The thieves' philosophy, which initially had conquered the archipelago, easily swept further and captured the all-union ideological market, a wasteland without any stronger ideology. The camp tenacity, its cruelty in human relations, its armor of insensitivity over the heart, its hostility to any kind of conscientious work, all this effortlessly tamed campside without difficulty, and then went on to make a deep impression on all freedom. Thus it is that the archipelago takes its vengeance on the Soviet Union for its creation. Thus it is that no cruelty whatsoever passes by without impact. Thus it is that we always pay dearly for chasing after what is cheap. To give a list of these places, these hick towns, these settlements, would be almost the same as recapitulating the geography of the entire archipelago. There wasn't a single camp compound which could ever exist on its own. Next door to it there had to be a settlement of free people. Sometimes this settlement at some temporary logging camp or other would stand there several years and disappear along with the camp. Sometimes it would put down roots, get a name, a town Soviet, a branch line, and stay there forever. And sometimes famous cities would grow up out of these settlements, like Magadan, Dudinka, Igarka, Temirtau, Balkhash, Jezkazgan, Angren, Taishet, Bratsk, Sovietskaya Gavan. These settlements festered not only in the outposts of the wilderness, but also in the very torso of Russia, around the mines of the Donbass and Tula, next to peat diggings, next to agricultural camps. Sometimes entire districts were infected and belonged to the world of campside, like Tonshayevo. And when a camp was injected into the body of a big city, even Moscow itself, campside, also existed, not in the form of a special settlement, but in the form of those separate individuals who flowed away from it every night on trolleybuses and motorbuses, and who were drawn back into it again every morning. In these cases, the transmission of the infection proceeded outside at an accelerated rate. There were also such towns as Kizel, on the Perm mining and metallurgical branch line. They had begun their existence before there was any archipelago, but subsequently turned out to be surrounded by a multitude of camps, and thus were transformed into principal capitals of the archipelago. Such a city would be permeated by the camp atmosphere. The camp officers and groups of the camp guards would go afoot or ride through it in droves, like occupying forces. The camp administration would be the city's main institution. The telephone network would not belong to the city, but to the camps. The bus routes would all lead from the city's center to the camps, and all the town inhabitants would earn their living off the camps. The largest of such provincial capitals of the archipelago was Karaganda. It was created by and filled with exiles and former prisoners to such a degree that a veteran Zek could not walk the street without running into old acquaintances. The city had several camp administrations, and individual camps were scattered all around it like the sands of the sea. Who lived in campside? 1. The basic indigenous local inhabitants. There might be none. 2. The VOKHR, the militarized camp guards. 3. The camp officers and their families. 4. The jailers and their families. And jailers, as distinct from camp guards, always lived with their families, even when they were listed as on military service. 5. Former Zeks, released from the local camp or one nearby. The Stalinist epoch has gone, and various warm and cold breezes have blown over us, but many former Zeks never did leave campside, never left their backwoods localities, and they were right not to. There they are at least half people, whereas here they would not be even that. They will stay there till they die, and their children will assimilate like the local inhabitants. 6. Various restricted persons, half-repressed people, people with unclean passports. Like the former Zeks, they too were here not of their own free will, but of necessity. Even if the particular place had not been assigned them as though they were exiles, it would be worse for them anywhere else in regard to both work and housing, and they might not even have been allowed to live anywhere else anyway. 7. The Works Administration. These were highly placed people and constituted in all only a few people in a big settlement, and sometimes there were none at all. 8. Then, too, there were the free employees, the volniashki, proper, all the tramps and riffraff, all kinds of strays and good-for-nothings and seekers after easy money. After all, in these remote death traps you could work 3 times as poorly as in the metropolis and get 4 times the wages, with bonuses for the Arctic, for remoteness, and for hardship, and you could also steal the work of the prisoners. And, in addition, many flocked there under recruitment programs and on contract, receiving moving and travelling expenses as well. For those able to pan the gold out of the worksheets, campside was a real Klondike. People swarmed there with forged diplomas. Adventurers, rascals, and money-grabbers poured in. It was particularly advantageous here for those who needed the free use of someone else's brains. A semi-literate geologist would have Zek geologists to carry out his field observations, work them up, draw all the conclusions, and then he himself could go defend his dissertation in the metropolis. They sent here the total failures, and those who were simply hopeless drunks. Men came here after their families had broken up, or to avoid alimony. Then, too, there were the young graduates of technical schools who had failed to get themselves into cushy spots when obligatory jobs were being assigned. But from the very first day of their arrival here, they began to try to get back to the civilized world, and whoever couldn't manage it in 1 year's time would certainly be able to do it in 2. But there was also quite a different category among the free employees, the elderly, who had already lived in campside for whole decades, and had become so assimilated to its atmosphere that they no longer needed some other, sweeter world. If their camp shut down, or if the administration stopped paying them what they demanded, they left. But invariably they would move to some other such zone near a camp. They knew no other way to live. This was the situation of Vasily Aksentievich Krolov, a great drunkard, a cheat, and a famous master of casting, about whom I could tell many tales, except that I have already described him. Without any diploma, and despite the fact that he had drunk down his last skill as a master, he never received less than 5,000 pre-Khrushchev rubles a month. In the most general sense, the word volniashka means just any free person. In other words, any citizen of the Soviet Union not yet arrested or already released, and therefore every citizen of campside. But most often this word was used in the archipelago in the narrow sense. A volniashka is that particular kind of free person who worked alongside prisoners in the same work compound. By this token, those in groups 1, 5, and 6 above, who came to the camp work compound to work, were also volniashki. This book is continued on Cassette 9, Side 1.